anticipate. 16 total gets made. Can we cross the line towards anyone dismayed? Can we go along, say, say, say? Caught me listening to water dripping from toes or lips to attend. Where it's gone. Don't need to say that anyone here will be thinking of modern ways. Can we go along, say, say, say? Hello. So in honor of our guest who is a swimmer, I googled blowing what kisses underwater. And there's some really talented, interesting people who can blow heart-shaped kisses underwater, all kinds of things. If you are bored and need to look at YouTube for a while, you could search that. My name is Swan, and I'm blowing you kisses from the basement of the Velo Bike Shop in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and you are listening to Ink and Worm, all things reading and writing, and I'm very excited to have two awesome gentlemen here today. We have Alex Shane, who is a literary agent, and you work at Writer's House, and you also are a sports writer for Pat's Pulpit, correct?
That is correct. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Do you want to talk a little bit about the kinds of books you represent? Because I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. The bulk of my list is very eclectic. I work in the children's and adult arenas.
Yeah.
And I guess if I had to describe it in one word to kind of make a blanket statement, it would be dude reads, I guess is the way to it. Anything that a dude would read. I like mystery novels and thrillers, horror novels are things I love. Anything sports, obviously, historical fiction, military biography, military memoir, military history, celebrity bios and whatnot. And I'm also very passionate about getting young boys to read again, because boys are really falling behind educationally in a lot of categories, and there's not much good content out there for them to read. So getting boys to read again is very important to me. So I love kind of middle grade 8 to 12-year-old adventure stories or ghost stories or kids getting into shenanigans and stuff like that.
Yeah, we talked about Brendan Mull's Fablehaven.
Sure.
Gosh, awesome. Yeah. I love the juxtaposition of, like, horror with, like, young boys.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up on the Goosebumps books. I loved those. Oh, yeah. R.L. Stine. And I'm a child of the 90s, so Snick, Are You Afraid of the Dark? I loved that. I kind of grew up on it. And my mother... Tales from the Crypt. The Crypt Keeper. I loved that stuff, yeah. And my mother was of the opinion when I was young, as long as I'm reading... She didn't really care what it was. So when I was about 8 or 9, she always had a Stephen King book in her hand, always. And I remember I'd come home from school, and she'd fix me a snack, and she'd tell me what was going on in the book she was reading. She'd dumb it down for kids. So she'd tell me how bad it was. But so I
fell in love. People are being murdered.
Yeah, no. So she was very like, she was like a PG Stephen King. And so one day I pulled Misery off the shelf, and she's like, I guess as long as he's reading, I don't care. So I read Misery at age 9 or so, and I've been hooked ever since on horror. So I love it, and that's kind of how I got into pretty much the reason I'm sitting here talking to you right now is because of Stephen King, kind of indirectly.
Oh,
so that's how I fell in love with writing, yeah.
One of our other show hosts, she hosts a music show called Earhammer. She works for, is it NPR? I think so. And she met him, and she does something called the Dolores Claiborne Minute, because she loves that movie, and she talked to him about it, and she just was like, Stephen King, it's you, and I'm like doing things inspired by you. So
that's awesome.
I guess it's like a similar thing in your story.
Yeah, absolutely.
Swam. Our other guest, Casey Barrett, you are an Olympic swimmer, co-founder of Imagine Swimming, and also a writer. You're currently writing a swim blog, Cap and Goggles, and your debut novel is coming out fall of next year, and it's called Underwater. Hi, welcome.
Thank you. I'm
close to the mic. It's like one of those weird technology things.
Thank you.
And you can pull it closer to you, too, if that helps. Welcome.
Thank you.
I would love to hear the story of how your book came about, Underwater, and maybe a little bit about it.
Yeah, absolutely. The story of how the book came about, first and foremost, crime fiction is really my biggest passion when it comes to fiction and reading, and ultimately I feel like any author that is honest with himself writes what he loves to read most. So after a failed attempt at a first novel in my 20s, that's the proverbial novel in the drawer, that made the rounds and never got through, I feel like I embarked on a really private and personal crime fiction apprenticeship and read as widely as I possibly could in the genre, and just kind of devoured everybody from the McDonald's, Raymond and Ross, or John Dee and Ross, some Chandler, tons of Jamie Lee Burke, Benjamin Black, Ken Bruin, James Crumley. I don't know. I can
extensive.
it's fun to talk about all the favorites. But eventually I felt confident enough in having developed some confidence in the genre. I'm not saying any mastery at all. It'll take dozens of books, I think, before I can confidently say that. But started on this novel where the character Duck Darley is someone that I've had developed really since 2006, and it wasn't until late 2010 where I really sat down and started writing. So I guess the character himself was germinating for a good 4 years as I was reading and letting this character kind of sink into my bones before I started writing about him.
Yeah. Was he triggered by an event or a person or?
I'm not going to say he was triggered by one event or person. You know, the name was one of those things that just kind of arrived. I guess in part, my favorite series ever is the Alexandria Quartet, Lawrence Durrell's Alexandria series. It started with Justine and the unnamed narrator, whose name you don't realize or you're not told until the very last book is Darley. And I have a little bit of an alliteration sickness.
You there's something about it. It speaks to the human psyche. A funny tangent. I am taking a class from Gotham Writers, and a fiction writing class, and I realize I have a really hard time naming characters. I would turn in pieces, and they'd be like, "So this is really great, but we don't find out their name until like the last page." And I'm like, "Oh yeah."
Yeah, I know.
As a gag, I did like this like 5-piece collection of unnamed characters. I was like, "Nah, they don't have names. Figure it out. It's universal."
Yeah, I feel like I'm trying to come up with a name. I'm just finding myself gazing at the bookshelf, and then inevitably, like the last names, it would take anybody 2 seconds to figure out. Oh, these are the writers he likes. Because they're in some way related.
I think my process. I need to write the entire book with just like she, her, they, whatever, and then go back like at the end and be like, by the way, what is her name? And then go back and be like, Molly, or whatever it is, you know, like, yeah, names. Names are tricky. As Tris Stein said, she's a mystery novelist. She's like, you know, you have to look at the year you're writing in, especially if you're working with anything that's like based in actual history, like what were people actually named and how common was that name? And like, what are the insinuations? Is that name more of like a, oh, they're like, my name's Swan. Oh, she's a fluffy creative, like whatever. Somebody named Patricia might be a little bit more grounded in something more, you know, traditional. She might be a banker. I don't know. I have a friend, Patricia, who works in advertising. Names are funny. Funny business. Anyway, so yeah, tell us the story of the story. So you wrote a novel, and then when did you guys become a team?
Well, it's funny. Casey actually came to me. A lot of my clients become referrals or are from referrals, and Casey... Basically, I should let you tell this part, Casey. He is the instructor to one of my colleague's daughters. Mm. He runs a swim school, very successful swim school. And his
the biggest in New York, I learned on the internet.
It is.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So to tell the quick story of how Alec and I got together, I actually did not teach the girl. Her name was Ruthie, and she was a kid who'd been with us a long time. And I was aware that her father, Simon, was a prominent literary agent, and looking at his list and the authors he's worked with, you know, no matter how arrogant an aspiring writer can be, you take one look at his list and
you're
there's
like, never mind.
There's absolutely no chance that that someone at that stature was going to be taking on a first time
aspiring crime novelist. But it's good.
as kind of part of the search that I think every first time writer goes about in search of the agent, which is a really daunting, humbling process.
Yeah.
I emailed him a short line, really just asking for advice. And I think I even said in the email, I know this isn't something that's you're going to be even considering taking on, but I'd love to hear your input. And a short time after that, he introduced me by email to Alec, and Alec can take it more from there.
And here we
There's
are.
More to it than that.
Actually, you know, it's actually a situation where he came to me. He's like, "Listen, this is he's got something there. I think he's a good writer. I'll take a look. No obligation, no pressure." So I did, and I read it, and I really enjoyed the manuscript. I really liked the voice. That was very folksy. I really liked the character. Obviously, there are a lot of crime novels out there where there's a detective and there's a missing person, and that trope has been done many, many times.
Yeah, yeah.
And so if you have a novel with a detective and a missing girl, for example, like there's got to be something unique about it to make it stand out in a very crowded market.
Yeah.
And he did that. He had this swimming angle that he used, and the PI, Duck Darley, was a former Olympic hopeful who kind of crashed down to earth, and now he's kind of trying to re-pick his life back up. And I really liked that tangent. I liked that voice, and I liked what he brought to the table. But honestly, the manuscript actually that he submitted to me the first time, I turned it down. I said, this isn't really ready yet. I can't take this on, but I like your writing a lot. I like your voice. What I'd love to do, if you're willing, is give you some notes. I'm going to come back, and if you want to revise a little bit and address some issues, I'm going to tell you what I think about it, and we can revisit the conversation down the road. So I'm passing for now, but I'm offering you a chance to revise and resubmit.
Mm-hmm.
And then we met for drinks, I believe, for some whiskey, and then we talked about the revisions, and he did it. And I believe we actually did that maybe twice that happened between the two of us.
Yeah.
I gave him two rounds before I officially offered representation.
So I'm going to interject. How many times had you gone over the book when you approached Alec?
So the first draft Alec saw was actually the third draft that I had written. And like he said, he passed on it with – it was an encouraging pass.
It's like, it's good, but
yeah,
keep working on it.
It's good, but not good enough. And this – I want to say three more times. The last round was – I think I was feeling more confident that there would be a yes there if I really didn't screw things up after that. But as I've told Alec, this would have been really annoying and really really daunting if not for the sad fact that he was always right about it. And it was – I mean I was really wanting to say, no, you're full of shit. Like you're not understanding it now. Someone else will,
my ego is wounded.
This.
It's your fault.
No, and I kind of wanted to say that, but there wasn't even ever that opportunity because, you know, every time it was like, okay, this – but like he's not wrong. He's absolutely right, and it does need to be better. And one thing I've learned in this process that I think goes to like more of the current state of publishing today is an agent's job, especially with first-time writers, is much more the editor's job. It's maybe the title is agent, but I considered Alec my editor more than that.
That's one of my talking points, so we'll revisit this. So he brought it to you, said it's awesome, but not enough.
Right.
Let's look at it.
It wasn't awesome. It
was basically, I really liked the voice. I liked the character.
And there was a potential angle there that was new and refreshing.
Yes, there was a fresh hook to it. I think that Duck Darley is not just your hard-nosed PI who's grizzled and on the force. And,
yeah.
You know, he's not the Harlan Coben kind of character, not a James Lee Burke kind of character. He's got that swimming hook. And Casey, obviously, is very knowledgeable of the swimming world, the Olympic sports world. And there's this whole – I'm not going to give too much of the book away, but there's this whole seedy underbelly of Olympic sports. And we think it's like this graceful kind of, no, the world comes together for 2 weeks every 4 years, and that's not really how it works.
Yeah.
And so getting behind the scenes was really interesting to me and seeing how that whole played out.
Well, here's a tangent. Competitiveness. You guys are both athletes and you write about sports. There's this competitive nature that I don't understand of like, we need to win, or let's talk about that for a little bit.
Especially in America. I mean, America, if you look at Olympic sports, and look at the way we look at silver medalists and bronze medalists.
You're like, oh, second best.
Yeah, like you don't come home if you want a bronze medal in the Olympics. You know, that's kind of how we treat our athletes. You know, you either win the Super Bowl or your season was a failure. It's insane. We only reward first place. Second place is the first loser. I think that was a No Fear shirt back in the 90s. Second place is the first loser. And it's just this whole culture we built around it. And I'm fascinated by Olympic sports, especially because basically these kids train their entire lives for 2 weeks. And then that 2 weeks is over, and then they're maybe 19 years old, and
then what?
They're not going to make any money. They're not going pro in shot put. And so what are you going to do with the rest of your life? It's a very fascinating dynamic. And that's part of what drew me to the book. Is just
who
that.
Was it? Robin Williams was one of his acceptance speeches. This is like the Oscars happened, and so everyone was like reviving things. And I just happened to see he's like – this is for my dad who said always have a backup plan, like welding or something. Like, I can't remember what it is specifically, but just like have a backup plan, like, you know, something blue collar.
That's true.
It's like, oh, yeah. I'm not competitive at all. It's kind of a fault. I'm a yogi and a rock climber and a runner because it's like, oh, I'm only working against myself. this butting up against someone else, I'm like, okay, you win. Like, you got it. So competitive, like, you encountered that in your life experience and you brought it to this novel. So you guys worked on it together. Let's progressing from there. It's due for release. What was that process?
Yeah, so basically, so Casey did a couple of revisions, like I said. I offered some representation, and then we, you know, signed the agency contract, started working together officially. Mm-hmm. And then I believe we did maybe two more rounds of revisions again after I'd officially signed him. And then we sent it out. I believe I sent it out, and I'm sure you know way better than I do, maybe March or so of last year, around that springtime of 2014.
Okay. Ironically, it was 2 years ago today.
Yeah. March of 2014.
Happy
wow.
anniversary.
Today. No, it's a grim. No, I'm sorry. We're overstating the pain. It was a 1 year ago today that it was sent out. It was March 6th of last year.
I think it's valuable. I'm transitioning more to a writer who's like, I don't care if I get published. I'm just trying to figure out what the hell I'm writing. Like, I have three boxes of journals, and I travel light, and everywhere I go, I'm carrying these journals. I'm like, what am I trying to get at? But a lot of writers are like, that's like kind of like the marker of like, I'm successful because here's this book. I made it a thing. So I think that's valuable for someone to hear, like, okay, first of all, I had to rewrite a book like 5 to 7 times, like literally sometimes even throw out the whole thing and be like, start over. It's not working. And then also once it's out there and moving and people are reading it and talking about it and helping you with it, it still takes time. Like, and I'm sure you get this a lot of people like pushing you being like, hey, when, like, how?
Yeah, no, sure. I mean, agents, obviously it's a glacially slow process sometimes. Editors are very busy. Basically what I'm doing is I'm the same way same way authors are submitting their books to agents. Agents do the exact same thing, just to editors and publishers, you know? Yeah. And so as long as it takes you as an author to wait for an agent to say yes or no, we as agents are waiting the exact same amount of time, sometimes longer.
Yeah.
As editors prioritize their current lists and they're, you know, taking the time to review a new manuscript takes some time, and it's kind of low on your priority list. Could you have people who are already on your list that are pounding on you to get the job done for them who have to take precedent over that?
Yeah.
And yeah, it took us a very long time, and a lot of editors passed, and a lot of editors will pass on Casey's book. They had wonderful things to say about the writing. There were times it came very close, but there were just these heartbreaking, really, really thanks, but no thanks. And I had to pass them on. But eventually, Kensington said yes, and he has a 3-book deal, which I'm really excited about.
Ooh, congratulations.
Yeah. So at least 3 Dr. Arley books, definitely a lot more will be coming out. And then now the fun part starts. Now the hard part starts. Because honestly, even though we did 5 or 6 rewrites with him and I, he got notes from his editor. He's got notes from his editor coming. So the revision process never really stops until there's actually a book on the shelf. And you literally can't go
it's
into
done.
It anymore.
Yeah,
you
can't and then
it,
you can do like another edition of like, here's all the mistakes I made.
Right. Here's what I wish I'd done.
Yeah.
To go back to your point on the competitiveness and what that breeds, because I felt like hearing Alec just talk right now, it really relates, I felt like for me personally, so closely to the, you know, it's an obsession that it takes over kind of your life in a way that has nothing to do with monetary gain or any kind of like rational goal that you can have. And swimming and writing are very close to that, at least in my own head, that you don't know why you're waking up so early and doing this. You don't know why you're losing your mind over something you want so badly. And I am one of a writer that they couldn't consider myself having, quote, made it or even mention it to anybody until that offer came. And that's not particularly healthy.
So I'm wondering about the echo chambers, because I've noticed when I write, I'm like, oh, this is so funny. And then like I have someone read it and they're like, one of my pieces is about a baby, but I don't ever say that. Okay, this is like longer than necessary. So basically it's written in first person. And you're in the mind of this person that's like, oh, look, there's a stick of butter on the table, but very intellectually like, how do I get to that stick of butter? And my teacher in my writing group was like, so I was reading through this, and I didn't realize it was a baby till the end, because this, like, the story is like, climb on the table, get the butter, smear it all over, like, enjoy like the sensation of butter, and then like climb off the table, start smearing it on the walls. And he's just like, I didn't realize it was a baby. And I found out, like, I did, and then I was like, but what if it wasn't a baby? And I'm like, what an interesting take. because I that's maybe a mindset that you don't get to step into very often. So I'm curious about your process of like, writing something and be like, oh, this works. Like, did you show, you said you didn't show it to anyone. So how was your process of like writing something with not, no feedback, I guess, is my question.
No, I definitely showed it to folks, after I felt a little more comfortable with it. You know, we started this talk about, or we kind of just kicked off just now about Stephen King, and to go back to him, his book on writing was like a million people. It's like an absolute touchstone for me.
That's the only Stephen King book I've read.
I mean, if you are a writer and you haven't read that, like drop everything and go get it.
Right? Yeah,
awesome.
It literally is. It's close to a how-to manual as it gets.
And absolutely.
I read it at a time in my life where it really I think was going to sink in, and I essentially just took his advice exactly, and some of his, I mean, he has a million, the whole book is filled with great advice, but one of his big things is that you finish a first draft and you set it aside for 4 to 6 weeks and you don't touch it, and then you go back and read it and edit it, and then you pick out a tiny small handful of trusted readers, not necessarily close
someone who's going to be honest.
Yeah.
You don't want really, I don't know who you don't want most people, but you want folks that are going to be honest and also aren't going to crush your spirit.
And a quick plug, I read in a writing book at some point of like lawyers make really good editors because they're going to look at it logically and be like, this makes sense, this doesn't make sense. And then also they're really good with the grammar piece, which is something you have a lot of like confrontation with of like, hello, basic like grammar.
Absolutely. And it's funny. And a lot of authors will query me and, you know, they'll be like, I gave this to my high school class and they all loved it. It's like, well, of course they loved it. You know, you're their teacher. And of course your mom's going to love it and your grandma's going to love it. And, you know, you want
to. That actually happened. A high school teacher was like, all my kids thought it was.
Happens all the time. Teachers, there's a lot of writers are also teachers. That's makes a lot of sense because they have time and they share their book with their third grade class or whatever it is, and the kids all eat it up. So, of course, that translates into this massive multinational bestseller. But if your teacher gives you a book, of course you're going to like it, either because you actually did or you want to get an A. So you're going to tell them you liked it.
Right.
You know? So Casey's right. You got to find people you trust. People are going to tell you how it is, but they're also not going to say, this sucks, never write again, because people out there like that as well. It's got to be very daunting to be an author and this your blood, sweat, and tears and this manuscript, and you're sending it out to basically be judged.
I can tell you the best source of that, if you're lucky enough to have it, is a wife who's both really smart and has a great editorial instinct and is also brutally honest. And I don't always like that I have that because, you know, you don't like being told that that you're off the mark in everyday life all the time. But I think Stephen King, who's been happily married, 50, 60, 80 years or something.
You find what works for you.
he's pointed out that like ultimately there's no editor or voice you trust more than your spouse. And my wife really is the only one who I really trust in terms of like her editorial judgment.
That's valuable.
So no, that's a lucky
and there's
lucky
this
voice to have.
Quote. I'm not going to remember who said it. I'll put it in the show notes. A true friend offends. And the speaker was talking about actually joining like this meditation retreat and how her meditation like guru, who she, you know, put on this pedestal, would just like say these things that were so like down to earth. And she felt like, ah, and then she realized like it is only because he had her best interest at heart. And if you give people fluff, they're going to be fluffy. And if you're like, okay, here's what I really think. This worked. This didn't work. Like this was confusing. And that, I think that's the value in, like, having a writer's group or a class or anything like that, is it gives you hard deadlines and it also gives you another, like, it gives you perspectives, so it gets you out of your own head. Nice. Cool. So Underwater is coming out Kensington fall of next year. Check it out. And when is, like, promotions happening?
We're a ways away from that. You know, I think with this point, we'll probably start seeing, you know, early publicity probably around this time next year. What we do, the good thing about having a 3-book deal like Casey got is we're taking this time to basically kind of front load his writing schedule. So once the first draft of Underwater is finished and in the can, he'll pretty much already have his rough draft of his next book written, so we can kind of stay one book ahead of the curve. So the reason we're one of the reasons we're delaying the pub date is because we can have that book always one ahead of the curve, and it just makes a lot of sense to have it next year because of just the way the Kensington pub schedule works out and how publication works. So yeah. Maybe spring of next year we'll start being a little more aggressive in our publication. But it's always good to get early publicity out there, get the name out, and start hitting the bricks.
It's definitely a disoriented thing when you look at the publication schedule versus the due dates, because the second book is due 4 months before this first book is supposed to come out. So it's hard to get your head around both.
And this might be a vulnerable question. How is it like knowing you have to follow up something? Do you already have ideas?
I'm actually 50,000 words into the second one, and it was the best thing. Best thing in the world was once that offer came in, it was 2 days after Thanksgiving. Sorry, 2 days before Thanksgiving this year. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't written much while it was on submission, and that's not really...
Because you're, like, holding your breath.
Yeah, and I don't believe in writer's block. I don't have it. I really think it's a joy to write, so I don't think there's such a thing as a block. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't doing much because I was just full of anxiety and drinking too much to get up and write in the morning. But literally right when that offer came in, it kind of opened the floodgates, and now it's just fucking great. Like, I just can't wait to wake up in the morning and write.
I am curious, because when you reached out to me, you talked about Chronology of Water, which is more memoir styled. Is that something great? You experimented with in terms of your experience, like writing a memoir?
No, I haven't.
Because I've noticed some of your blogs are more like, here's my experience of this thing.
Yeah, I guess maybe that's the outlet for it. Because I definitely, the writing, a lot of the writing anyway on my blog is really kind of personal essays, which I can't say on the term personal essays, but I don't really have a better term for what I'm doing there. I love that,
I think,
that form. I love the genre of it, but it's not really what I want to do in book form.
Interesting. I love the love affair you have with swimming. You're like all things swimming, art, books, like everything related. It's obviously impacted your style of writing now in terms of like your crime, but with a swimming undertone. How much has like swimming influenced your writing process?
I'm actually really always surprised that there's not a library of more swimming related books the way there is in baseball and boxing. I think those are kind of the two sports that have this very rich literary tradition. And there's not in swimming, but the act of being a swimmer is, to me, virtually identical to the act of being a writer. It's the solitary focus, and there's the slow patience of writing. And then there's the times where you kind of come out and show what you've done, which is the same as, you know, months and years later, you show what you've done at a big meet.
You're like, I've been training every day for 3 years.
Yeah, exactly.
So ready.
to me, it's like one and the same. I can't really understand why more former swimmers aren't writers, because it's the same instinct and the same lifestyle.
Hmm. I think masochism as well is a word you got to use. I can barely swim, so I don't know anything about swimming. But reading Casey's novel, like, he really gets inside the head of a swimmer, and I just these college kids getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning. Hmm. To go hit the pool for 5 o'clock in the morning, and they do it twice a day for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I think about what I was doing at 4 o'clock in the morning in college, and it wasn't getting up to go swim. You know, and
sometimes I was going to bed.
Yes, if you're lucky. I'm like a Tuesday. You know? So I think that there's a certain element of a lot of athletes who do things that are very rigid disciplined actually make very good writers, because they can use that focus and that mentality, and that it really is. It's such like a grueling process when you're writing, because it's just you in front of a computer. And it's just nobody else around.
Yeah.
And you can get up anytime you want and give it all up and go away, but you don't, because you have to do it. You know, we do it because we have to, I think, is the way you do it.
Yeah. It's whether it's a sickness or not, you have no choice in the matter.
Masochism.
And there's a very literal thread to masochism in the book, in the series. And Duck's partner is a dominatrix, and is his sometime partner, Cassandra Kimball, who is a character I love developing her as a character. I just think she provides such a great foil to Duck. And
People are so intrigued by things like that. I mean, even if you're in the industry, so to speak, like, it's still something that you're like, what are other people doing? Like, people are so fascinated with it.
It is fascinating. And I don't know. It's the her name is a nod. We, you were talking earlier about your favorite books growing up as a kid. I was all about Encyclopedia Brown, and Sally Kimball is Encyclopedia's partner, and it's meant to be kind of a subtle nod to that, in that Sally Kimball was the smarter one that kind of always did figure things out, even though it was all about Encyclopedia Brown. And that's a little bit of the relationship that that Duck has with his partner Cass. That she really is the smarter, more capable one, and he just happens to be the one with the access. Mm. People come to him due to his background. He was a very, very wealthy kid once upon a time who fell on very hard times, but that gives him the access. But ultimately, it's his partner who really has the insights and does the real legwork in many cases.
Interesting. Well, I look forward to reading it. I did lots of Google stalking, and I noticed that one of your, most popular represented books was called Star Wars?
Shark Wars, sorry.
Yes. My mistake. It just reminded me, I just saw Jaws for the first time last night.
Wait, really?
I'm like a failure as a human being. The storytelling.
I'm leaving. You made up. I'm out of here.
Okay.
Pouring more whiskey, by the way. Thanks
for coming. Have you done lots of open water swims? That makes me think of like feeling exposed to the elements of nature. It's like this, like a. I think every human has it. Like, oh god. Like,
you know, I've done a couple, but I'll tell this very quick story about a very close friend. He lives in out in Southern California, and he's now done it a couple times. It's the Catalina swim from Catalina Island to the mainland.
Yeah.
And you leave due to the tides and whatever. Ideal conditions. You leave at midnight with no moon, and you swim in pitch darkness with a few friends with glow sticks on kayaks, and you swim in pitch darkness from Catalina Island to the shore. Jeez. And these are, I'm told, extremely shark-infested waters, and you hear every once in a while sharks thrashing beneath you and circling you, and
that's living on the edge.
Yeah, we go
swimming
back
on the edge.
Talk about love for horror fiction. There's a fine book to be written there. Yeah. Because this, I mean, you talk about a certain masochism of a swimmer's personality. This is a guy who knowingly and joyfully does this and gets in the water at midnight in very cold water. Yeah,
you're
doesn't
like,
get much
I could
warm.
Die. It's all right.
Yeah,
it's like Russian roulette. You're like, what are the odds?
Yeah. But you know, he'll tell you that.
And that makes me feel alive.
He'll say you have better odds of crashing your car on the way to the swim, like every extreme sport nut will do. But swimming in pitch darkness in shark infested waters, surrounded by a few kayaks and glow sticks, that sounds like horror to me.
That's not something I don't think I'd volunteer for. I did do a night triathlon. I mentioned I was helping kids do triathlons, and so I participated sometimes. That one was fun because everyone had, like, glow-in-the-dark paint and things on their bikes, and it was, like, a party. But there weren't any sharks because it was Utah. Like, so at least we had that safety.
And because it was Utah, you weren't on drugs during the triathlon?
I don't think I was on drugs.
All right.
Yes. In hindsight, you know, what can you say, what can't you say? Just kidding. Let's revisit this idea of, like, as an agent, you actually double as a pretty solid editor for
Absolutely.
People because you don't want an editor to see it until it's actually ready for someone to see industry.
Yeah. I mean, the fiction market, particularly the crime fiction market, is very crowded. There's a lot of crime authors out there, a lot of great crime fiction out there, as Casey mentioned at the beginning of this program. And so if you're a new author, no one knows who you are. You're just some random person.
You better have a good thing.
It's got to be pretty damn close to perfect when you send it out there. Because I feel like, especially in the crime arena, readers are very loyal to their authors. Mm. And adult readers especially have...
And there's so much production. Like,
yes.
Authors will just keep being
Absolutely.
Like, and here's another book, and here's another
book. All the good crime writers, they're a book of your crime writers. What they do. Every year there's a new Jack Reacher book or whatever it may be. And so you have very limited time to read if you're a crime reader. And so you take your authors, you stick to them. Mm. And so why would some random person that hasn't written a book before be worth anybody's time? So you have to make sure that the book you send out to the editor has this mentality. They know that they're going to have to be very tight with their budget, what they offer, what they don't. So I do a lot of editorial work with my fiction authors. Casey and I, like I said, we did a lot of drafts of this, and it was pretty close to perfect. And when we sent it out, we still got a lot of passes. We got an editor that bought it. And again, the editor, I think, right now is compiling some notes for him. So it goes through a lot of rounds. And when you are looking for your agent, keep that in mind, that your agent is probably going to do a lot of edits with you at this point, because as the market gets tighter and tighter and publishing, as an industry continues to shift and grow and evolve, agents need to be a lot more hands-on because it's just tough out there.
So as an agent slash editor unofficially, what is something that you see a lot in people subscribing or submitting you work? Like, what's something that's like a common writer's mistakes, if you will?
Mistakes? I think what the biggest mistake that I think authors make is we are living in a society, in a world now where we all want it right now. Mm. We're very impatient in general. You know, if the movie that came out this past Friday isn't illegally downloading fast enough on my laptop, I get really mad.
Yeah, right? I do that too.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's not my movie's not downloading fast enough so I can stream it. Like, that's kind of the mentality we have now.
Yeah.
And as Casey said, he started thinking about his character in 2006.
Mm.
So it's been 10 years.
It's been
this book's been 10 years coming. And who wants to wait several years for their book? So I think a lot of times authors will send the book out to agents before it's ready to go. And they just kind of want to get it out there and see what happens. And they're not really willing to put the time and grind and make it work for them. So that's probably the biggest thing I see authors.
And you are selling a product. I mean,
yes.
So you have to look at it in some sense of like objectively, like, would I buy this product? Even like if I hadn't produced it, would I have bought it?
Right. And agents, basically, if an agent signs you on as an author, he or she's working for free until that book sells.
Yeah.
So if I'm going to take a book on, I have to love it enough to want to work for free on the chance it might never sell. You know, I've had books that I couldn't sell.
Because you believe in what it was.
Right, because I believe in the author, I believe in the product. But, you know, if I didn't sell Casey's book, all the work him and I did wouldn't have made any of us any money. You know, and so you got to be very careful what you take on, which is why authors have to do a lot of legwork up front.
Yeah.
You know, because what needs to happen?
So make sure, as an author, if I'm like, oh, I've never been published, I better make sure my manuscript has been, like, combed over at least 3 times, if we're being honest, more, before I even let people in the industry see it.
I always tell authors when they ask the questions, like, how do I know when it's ready? That's a question I get a lot as an agent. It's like, how do I know when my book is ready? And my answer to that is there's going to be a point when you've written it and rewritten it and workshopped it and then reworkshopped it and you've kind of done all these things and you've danced and danced and danced. And you get to the point where you're like, if I look at this thing one more time, somebody's going home in a body bag. And you get to that point, that mentality. Yeah. And like, when you're at that point,
and then it shifts from masochism to sadism.
Yes, you're like, I'm going to shoot somebody if I see this and read this again. Yeah. And I think at that point, when you literally just can't look at it objectively anymore, because we're all very close to our work.
Yeah.
And there are certain things you're just not going to be able to see as the author that a fresh set of eyes will be able to see.
To you.
Right.
You care
and
about
so,
it too much.
Yeah. When you get to the point where you just literally cannot look at it again. Then you're probably ready to send it out.
But I mean, that also goes to the point where it really isn't a choice. I know that I remember years and years ago, my sister sent me some card she'd seen of a Bukowski quote, where it's, you know, Bukowski has lots of trite sayings, even though people adore him. But you know, talking about how if you don't need to do it, stop. If you have any doubts, stop. And you know, all that rant about it is goes to a real truth of it, because there's nothing rational or sane about trying to sit down and write fiction and thinking
and
you're going to have
creating something out of nothing.
Yeah. It has to be a need. You have to be kind of a little bit out of your mind.
And
to
I think
do it.
Especially in New York, where we're so saturated with people who are like, oh yeah, I'm a writer, but actually like, oh, you're a playwright who has like legitimate plays out in the world, or you're a writer who has like 12 books out. Like this like area of the country, of the planet, is just like so more people read here than I think I heard a statistic saying 41% of hardcover books are sold in New York City.
Wow.
Like, people just are interested in words
in
this city. We really care about writing and what people are.
And I also think that
doing.
We as like a species are writing more than we ever have ever.
Absolutely.
You know,
and it's so accessible.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You can write a blog and publish, or you can publish. This is something I wanted to touch on: publishing something yourself.
Sure.
As a literary agent, as I understand, that's something that you're not quite as willing to touch, because it's kind of gone as far as it's going to go if someone's published something themselves.
Yeah, what happens a lot when I get submissions is some version of, I self-published this, it really didn't go very well, can you now sell it for me? That's kind of what happens.
Fix it.
Yeah, fix it, pretty much. Now, there's some fantastic self-published work out there, but the problem is, all you need in 2016 to be a published author is a computer. And a mouse, and you click publish, and your book goes up on Amazon.
And there's so many curating sites, too.
There's so many, and there's so many self-published books out there. There's just no way of distinguishing yourself. Mm-hmm. And for every book like The Martian that was self-published that did very well, there's hundreds of thousands that will never get read and aren't very good and probably aren't worthy of being published. And so I think self-publishing is a very valid and legitimate way of going about publishing books. I really believe in it. But you have to be – it has to be a conscious choice to self-publish it, not like I'm going to – as a resort, it's been rejected everywhere. I'm just going to throw it up on Amazon and see what happens.
And maybe somebody will read it.
I mean, you can go online and find a million reasons why – you know, why deal with the traditional mindset of publishing? And this is a dinosaur and this and that. And why not just self-publish? But you know what? The gatekeepers are there for a reason. And I say that with the deepest respect for those gatekeepers, because that, you know, that to me, whether you're talking about journalism or fiction or any kind of writing, the role of the editor and the role of the agent, I think, is more valuable than it's ever been, because there's such a tidal wave of content out there.
Yeah.
So you need those
curators.
Your
content needs to be like,
you have to have those curators who are great at it and understand markets and understand exactly how to phrase things and frame things. And, you know, yeah, you're sitting there in a room alone when you're first writing it. But, I mean, the process of getting a book out is like there's an awful lot of valuable people involved. And you can't deny that, as much as people really – I think kind of badly want to.
I think it's that immediate gratification of like, look, I have a book.
It is.
I made it.
And it's funny, what happens actually as well, I get a lot. You know, authors, it's very important to sell yourself as an author and tell me about any writing credits you may have and any kind of experience you may have and anything that might kind of build you and set you apart from anybody else, because I get personally 30 or 40 new emails a day from authors. Mm-hmm. So that's 40 new books a day, every day, 7 days a week coming into my inbox.
Yeah.
So to distinguish you from all these people, authors will try and, you know, build themselves up, and they'll
like
be these –
I've been self-published.
Yeah. So no, what they'll do is, you know, they'll self-publish 3 books, and maybe one of those books will have won a pie at their local library for like, you know, best book pie. And then it'll spend one day on an Amazon bestseller list because it gets knocked down to 50 cents and there's a million Amazon bestseller lists. And they'll come at me saying, I'm a multi-published award-winning best-selling author here with this new novel. Yeah. And that's just not the reality of it. So you got to be careful as well in that respect.
Well, and in terms of breaking into the industry, there is some value in having smaller pieces published in credible magazine publications.
Yes,
like,
absolutely.
Like start submitting. Is that a process that you did?
I can't say I did it in any.
But you
any
had your blog
publishing.
That had a lot of interactions.
I did. My my biggest writing, as far as credible writing experience I had before my blog or sitting down and writing fiction was, I was a writer for NBC Sports and for Bob Costas.
And you
for
won
years.
Awards.
they're kind of bullshit awards. People would say they have Emmys, like I do. And sometimes there's Emmys literally that like 300 people win at once. they're
Merry
such...
Christmas! It's like team sports as a kid. You're like, I played soccer and I scored one goal, it's like, and I have a trophy.
Yeah, there's people with Emmys that they're like participation awards, and right now they're like in the back behind the door of our bedroom with my wife's jewelry on it. It's just they're total horseshit. But
necklace holder.
Yeah, they're perfect. They're actually wonderful
and
necklace holders.
And rings that aren't.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what they were born to be. But at the same time, you know, Kensington will probably include that on my book jacket that I've won Emmys. And, you know, you have to sell yourself. I understand that. But, you know,
it's credibility in a sort, in a way.
It's phony credibility, but it,
and, you know,
that doesn't take away
things,
from the work you
arbitrary
do.
Arbitrary things still have meanings.
Yeah, no, it does. Yes. But I will say this, though. It really – the one thing I always tell everybody whenever I get any question about writing and publishing in general is like, if you are a good writer with a really good story, that's all that really matters at the end of the day, because a great book
there's
is a great
There's
got
to be a core to it, I imagine.
I think people know good writing when they see it and good books when they see it, and that's kind of all we're looking for.
Well,
at the end
promising.
Of the day.
And I mean, it's in one sense, it's the most subjective thing in the world. It's, you know, whether you're looking at a piece of art or watching a movie or reading words on a page, like it is subjective as can be, but at the same time, like, you know, quality when you're in front of it.
Yeah. Well, and so this kind of plays into what we've been talking about, but you've read quite a lot. You've read a lot and you get queries every day. So in terms of dealing with content, I just recently stopped reading books that weren't interesting.
Good job.
I used to have a compulsion of like, I've got to finish it. Yeah, I have to know what happens. And then I finish it. I'm like, I still hate it. Right. Why did I waste my life?
No, wait, that reminds me of a question I have for Alec. When he mentioned 40 emails a day or 4 new books a day, All right, so that's...
Like 10 pages...
That's 400 right. pages a day, yes. 400 new... the first 10 pages of 40 books a day.
So do you... Right, so you obviously you speed read. Books a
week. How you much skim. Do you
get? Yeah, I mean, it really depends. You know, sometimes... there are definitely times you can read two sentences and you know, this person's not a good writer. And I'm out. And then sometimes I'll get to the full 10 pages and it'll be a good story, but it'll be... You know, I get a lot of books that are very similar. I think a big mistake authors make, actually, is they look at what's selling well right now. They chase trends and like, okay, so, you know, what's hot right now? And
vampires.
Yeah, vampires are hot right now, or dystopians hot right now. And so they kind of chase trends, not realizing that, as Casey's a great example.
Trends are already happening.
Trends happened 2 years ago by the time the book comes out.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I'll see a book, it's good, but I can't sell it because the market's too crowded. And sometimes I'll request the whole thing. I'll read it. Sometimes I'll request the whole thing. I'll read it twice, and I'll say no. It really depends on the story and the situation. I've had situations like Casey's where I gave an author notes and revision notes and whatnot, and –
and seeing where they took it.
Right.
I'm sure you do that a lot and people are like, oh, okay. And you never hear from them again.
Sometimes they don't. And sometimes they come back with it and they didn't quite get it. They don't quite know have the critical eye and they can't really handle the critiques. And I will say no to that. So it's really not really a straight answer. I don't give it any particular amount of times. It's really subjective.
So it's not a formula.
No. It's not a formula. It really isn't.
I can't just Google what's selling.
Again, if it's on the shelf – the trend is over.
Right.
So don't write that.
Don't write that.
Yeah.
That's actually I like that sentence. If it's on the shelf, don't write it.
Right.
Somebody's already done it.
Right.
I think
that's,
a lot of times –
that's a very good line and a good piece of advice.
As writers too, like you're like, oh, but I'm so inspired by E.M. Forrester, so I want to write something like that. But it's like – he did it.
Right.
I mean, find your own voice.
Right. I mean, there are formulas that work. I mean, you know, Casey's book is a classic, like, great crime noir story. It's a detective missing girl in New York City. He has to find her. That's a very –
but it's got interesting details.
Yes, that's a tried and true formula, and it's going to always going to work.
Yeah.
Whenever there's someone's missing,
archetypes.
Someone has to find them. That's going to work. But you have to find a new way to approach it, you know?
Yeah.
It's important.
I like that. Do either of you listen to Tim Ferriss's blog ever?
I have not. Have you?
No.
No.
Tell us about it.
Oh, you know, he talks about things and he finishes with rapid fire where it's like a series of questions. And so we're about time to start this rapid fire. So series of questions, we can go on as long as we want, or the answer might be, I don't know, or whatever. So first question, my show is about reading and writing. You're listening to Ink and Worm. I'm your host, Swan. Thanks for tuning in. My show, I really enjoy focusing on the words that have shaped people. So these questions are more geared towards, like, you know, words that have shaped you. And what book have you not gotten around to reading?
I haven't gotten around to reading a lot of books, honestly. I love my job so much. But a big negative is if I spend all day around reading and writing, I don't want to come home and read a book. I want to come home and watch, like, crappy horror movies, or I go to the gym. So there's a lot of books that are piling up. But I loved The Voice by James Kaplan. It was the biography of Frank Sinatra.
Ah.
And loved it, tore through it. And he wrote a subsequent follow-up to that book called The Chairman, which was a Sinatra biography of the Capital One years, the Rat Pack years. That's kind of like the sequel to The Voice. And it's on my shelf and sitting there forever, and I really want to get to it. So that's probably the one whenever I get a free moment to read, for me, I'm going to read that.
Like a four-day weekend, maybe?
Yeah.
All right, I'll give you a rapid fire. Cormac McCarthy, Blood Meridian. I have a lot of guilt over not having read enough of Cormac. I need to read more Cormac.
And so many people talk about that one.
I know.
And there's that one sentence
I'm ashamed not having read him.
There's the one sentence in that book that's like 40 lines long, and it's one sentence,
right.
But it's like that's what he does. He's like, let's condense because this is so intense and it's just like happening.
Yeah.
Everyone
has
punctuation.
Has reader's guilt, right? We all do.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Cormac is the top of my list of reader's guilt.
I think he's up there. I've never read a book by him, and now that I'm thinking about it, and it's I think a big handful of his books are on my list, you know.
Well, you just saw Jaws, so you're right, way behind the times. Inexcusable.
I don't really watch things very often. Okay, so I watch Bob Burgers. I'm like reference that. That's like one thing I watch. And then I've been catching up. I didn't watch things as a teenager very much, so I've been catching up on Gilmore Girls, which is asinine sometimes, but also has a lot of value.
Hey, whatever works.
And the way they talk, and I'm just like, oh, their words are so pretty. is there a book you remember your parents reading to you?
Reading to me. It's funny. It's not reading to me. But there's this book. It's a picture book. It's all illustrations, no words. I forgot the author's name, but the title title is The Old Lady and the Strawberry Snatcher. The Gray Lady and the Strawberry Snatcher. And it's basically this woman who buys strawberries at the market, and this guy steals her strawberries. He's trying to steal her strawberries. She keeps eluding him. And my mother made up the story to me, and she basically tell it to me. As she was showing me the pictures, very, very young, back when I was a very young boy, and I remember it so well. And that's
like silent film in book form.
Yeah, it's just straight illustrations. It's beautiful. Again, The Gray Lady and the Strawberry Snatcher. Look it up. But there's no text at all. My mother kind of just made the text up, and there's some lines I still remember to this day.
Oh, how beautiful! Yeah. Thank you.
Shel Silverstein, definitely.
Oh, phenomenal. Good call.
Yeah. That's my daughter's obsessed with it now, and my first memories of hearing. Hearing reading was my mom reading that to me.
Fantastic. Do you have any rituals or routines based around your reading or writing? You do some writing as well, so.
I do. Okay, most of my writing is around NFL and Patriots, so it's kind of Sunday centric. But in terms of like reading, I do, especially when I'm reading for pleasure. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of my reading, author reading, on my Kindle, my e-reader. Mm. I make a very specific point to purchase and read my pleasure books on print still. I still buy books a lot.
Oh, interesting.
I kind of separate work from pleasure by
a more tactile experience when it's for you.
Although I always make a point to read my clients' novels when they come out in hardcover form. I really enjoy
that. It's like a nice, that.
Yeah, it's a nice
I
way.
Helped this happen.
Right. One thing.
Are you critical when you do that?
No, it's funny. Like it's impossible to fully turn off my editor's eye. I can't like take my editor's hat off completely, which really sucks. But you know, it's always really fun to revisit a book that you've been working on for X number of years. When it's done, it's on the shelf.
I think it's like painting. Painters are like, it's never done. It's just when I decide to stop working on it and move on to something else.
Right. But to know like you read the first draft of this on your laptop and you're reading it in a hammock a couple years later is really, really cool.
Reading in a hammock is cool in general.
That's all. I mean, that's all I want to do is like read in a hammock and pen.
Encyclopedia, and you're fine.
I have a good idea. Let's open a bookstore that has hammocks.
Genius.
Genius.
Right. Yeah, and then let dogs run around, pet dogs, and read in hammocks.
We went to the park once, and I don't think you had been there before. Like off leash hours, and you're like, it's like recess.
Yeah.
I'm like,
happy.
It totally is. Yeah. It's like dog recess. It's
dog
great.
Recess.
Rituals, routines.
All right. Rituals, routines. Writing, that's easy. I'm up unless I'm out the night before, which I try not to do very often when I'm focused on a project. But alarm goes off at 5:30, and I basically it's a great race before my daughter wakes up, which is usually around 7:30. So
2 hours.
Yeah, get up and make quick coffee and just be in the chair as fast as possible and crank as much as I can. The goal is 1,000 words. That's not always hit. But that's the goal. And then I have a little shop near my office that I don't tell anybody where I go, even though it's very nearby, that on lucky days I'll sneak off at about 3:30, 4 o'clock and try to give myself like 2 hours there. And the ritual is identical. I've been going there a long time, and it's a cappuccino and club soda. And it's a really like just – again, it's like a race to try to like get done what you want to get done. And if I do, I reward myself with a Stella before I leave. And if not, I don't. And it's just a – I always feel like when maybe someday I'll be writing and that'll be my one income producer. But it's not. And – every time I feel like I'm writing the things I really care about, it's a race. It's just a race before
to get it out. Get it out before you have to go back to real life?
Before life intrudes again, which I think hopefully raises some of the quality and the urgency of it.
There's a romance writer, right up your alley.
Love that stuff.
Sarah McLean, but I interacted with her in person and I asked a question about this and she was like, you know, honestly, ever since I quit my day job, I'm not writing as well. Like I like my first books when it was like a hustle. And I think there's something
fear.
To be said for
there's
that because it's like
has fear. Yeah.
It has value and contrast and there's a sense of urgency that if you quit your day job, that's gone. You're like, oh, I have all day to write.
Right. No, that's, that's a terrible thing to have. you need the urgency. But for reading rituals, I don't have the screen on that often. I mean, Alec is reading for a living and I'm not – So I love being able, I'm permanently behind on every great TV show. And I know there'd be great inspiration.
Yeah, people talk
to
about it. Game of Thrones.
Yeah, zombie. What's the zombie one?
Walking Dead. Thank you.
I hear those things are wonderful. I've never watched a single episode of any
people
of them.
People are really into them.
Yeah. But I would much, much rather be.
That's okay.
That was whiskey spilling.
Can't take this guy anywhere.
Yeah. The rituals of reading are reading just, you know, obsessively at night, but also my bag sitting next to me, I'd never, ever anywhere without a book.
Don't leave house without a book, yeah.
You can't. Like, it's better to need it and not have it than have it and not need it. Yeah. I just got that backwards.
You got it. Need it, not have it.
Yeah. And there is, I mean, we're going on this question, this is the point, but neural pathways. So someone recommended, like, start listening to the same playlist every time you sit down to do something, and it's going to reinforce the neural pathways. It's like if you're an artist and you're going to paint, listen to your painting playlist because your brain's going to, like, respond to those triggers. And over time, like, you know, a couple months later, you're going to hit that playlist and you're going to be like, okay, painting mode. And your brain just, like, transitions into that.
Yeah,
state of
totally.
Mind faster. So, I mean, is that something that you've had experience with in your industry?
No, I mean, it's tough because basically when you are an unagented author looking for representation and querying an agent, we as agents, I can't speak for everybody, obviously, but I basically read those kind of new author queries whenever I have time.
Yeah.
Be it on my phone,
in line
at the grocery store or like on the train
home. So it better grab you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's really hard. It's like the time. I don't have time the way that authors do to, like, all right, I'm going to sit down and do X, Y, and Z and then do it. I just have, like, whenever I can fit some time in to read, I do, because a lot of my job as an agent isn't reading. It's managing careers. It's making sure books are on schedule, doing publicity, getting marketing plans together. And so the reading kind of comes whenever I can get some time to do it.
Yeah. So I love this question. I feel like most people had this book when they were transitioning into puberty that, like, changed them or just, like, opened something up. Have you had a book that, like, was influential during puberty?
During puberty?
During your teenage formative years.
Reading books is not what I did a lot during puberty, I have to say. I read a lot of magazines during puberty.
What kind of magazines? Just
kidding. I can answer that, but it wasn't really – I think it was like pre-puberty. Yeah. But it was like –
yeah, like when you're 13, just like pushing into that, like, I'm – hormones, things are happening. I feel things. I think about things differently.
Yeah, I think Alec just indicated, like, for me, Roald Dahl was like
–
he was like everything to me. And then I just went into like a haze of puberty Sports Illustrated for a long time. And I didn't stop reading, but I was reading sports and obsessed with sports and obsessed with things that didn't necessarily take my imagination into you know, wild places that I'd loved when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And it was almost like Roald Dahl, like, kind of bid me farewell.
Yeah.
It's funny. Actually, my all-time favorite book is Danny, Champion of the World by Roald Dahl.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Like, I have a first edition. I'll get from one of my authors gave me a first edition for, like, a thank you for publishing her book present.
Oh,
and I've got it on my
fantastic.
Shelf. It's amazing. And that's what I loved about that book is there are very few, even to this day, like father-son relationship novels out there. And I really enjoyed that.
Nice.
And here's like a transitional, like, kind of like puberty book. Again, like, I pretty much grew up on Stephen King. And I guess, like, I read the probably third or fourth Stephen King book I read was The Shining, which was around puberty time.
Yeah.
And it's the first novel I read of Stephen King's that I wasn't, like, terrified of. So I felt like I was more of a man.
You're like, I got it.
I've transitioned into manhood where I'm not hiding under the blankets.
I'm not having nightmares.
Yeah, I'm having nightmares over this book because I'm 14 now and I read The Shining.
I can take The Shining now.
I can take it. Yeah.
Great. Well, Casey, Alec, thank you so much for coming. You've been listening to Ink and Worm, All Things Reading and Writing. Empty Orchestra is next, exploring the dynamic relationship between song and singer in the context of karaoke with Angelica and Amanda. And I'll leave you with a word, take it or leave it. Proclivity.